This is meals for the elderly or guiding people around the local abbey. This is in England and St Albans. She's very active, always doing things for others. And then when she came back, she'd be watching TV or doing this or visiting people. And suddenly she couldn't be active anymore. Suddenly she couldn't be out helping people and doing things. And it was such suffering. She got nothing to distract her mind. So anyway, we moved and we went to Ireland. We went to live in a little cottage in Ireland. She didn't know anybody there. She thought it would be wonderful, you know, to move and live in a beautiful place. Can you imagine a little old cottage in Ireland with the mountains behind, the sea in front, and a deserted peninsula where everyone, you know, you go to buy something in the shops and instead of being pushed over by trolleys and these huge supermarkets or walking through the glass door, everyone talks to you for hours. When you just walk in to buy an egg, and how are you? And they want to know everything about you. She loved it. You know, when you're lonely and you're old, you just want to tell them everything, don't you? It's perfect. And then she moves to this place, this beautiful place, with fields all around, and sheep, and just the sound of the sky, and the sea, and the sheep, and the cattle, and it was terrifying for her because it was just her and her mind. And all this stuff that she'd pushed down for years just started coming up. It's all coming up. And her body was just decaying around her. She literally had open bleeding wounds. I mean, the whole body was just falling to pieces. She was rotting from inside with cancer. I didn't even realize how bad it was, but literally she was rotting inside. And she had no choice but to do the work. She had no choice but to face all these demons. So Rinpoche loves that when people suddenly have this realization they're going to die. Why? Because there is in that moment the possibility for change. Actually, if you read this book, Ultimate Healing, you'll find that he gives several case studies of people who were going to die, and then he gives them practices, and they go off and they do them, and they don't die. But because there was that momentum, they really wanted to change. And then my mother was very, very interesting to watch her, you know, a year and a half, watching her go through her depressions and her stuff and her this and her that. And what do you have when you're old? Many, many memories, isn't it? Memories. Regrets. A lot of regrets. His Holiness says, whatever has passed, you can't bring back. Can't do anything about it. It's gone. However much time we've lived, we've wasted, we can't bring it back, it's finished. We can only work with the present and the future. Even the future we don't know, do we? So we're really left with the present moment. But I saw with my mother, I saw how she struggled, and I saw how what became precious to her was other people. And she would have, you know, when you get sick, when you get old, it's like a layer is stripped away from you. You become very, very sensitive. Very sensitive to the energies of others. I remember one guy coming, and he was this tall guy. We'd actually invited his friend to come, and she bought him. He was her boyfriend. And he was full of himself. You know, he'd been to India, and he'd cycled around India, and he thought he was great. You know the kind of guy? He thought he was God's gift to mankind. My father was sitting there listening to this guy tell us all how great he was, and she was shaking. I had to actually get him out of the house in a nice way. It was just ego pouring out. And of course she was drinking it up because he's a boyfriend, you see. But my mother was just shaking. And then she had a nurse who was so kind. My mother would look forward all week to her coming. And then after she'd been, she'd just talk about her. Oh, no, wasn't she kind? Don't you think she's kind? Isn't she kind? it was like this amazing appreciation of the kindness of others. And before she would have been quite critical, but I remember even, you know, people would do something and I would complain. She'd say, no, don't say that. Don't say that. What became so important to my mother was kindness. It became really, really important to her. And she kept this little book and she'd write down things in it. It wasn't for me to see, but after she died I opened it up. And she'd written there some of her thoughts and her feelings. And one of the things she'd written down was, I really hope that after I die, people will think of me as having been kind. Oh, I cried a lot when I read that. Of course she was very kind. Of course she was. But it was so precious to have that experience. And I remember towards the end of her life, there was about 6 days of utter trauma as she was dying and, you know, terrible things, having operations and being in intensive care and all the whole trauma of being in the hospital system. And I remember after she died, I went through her whole death and out the other side. And I remember thinking to myself, now at that point I'd been ordained maybe 14 years. Maybe I'd been a Buddhist 17 years, I think. And I remember thinking to myself after she died, you know, if I only had 5 minutes left to live, of all the practices and all the teachings that I've ever received, what is it that I would do with that last 5 minutes? And it was so clear to me, I would just try to be kind. It just seemed like there wasn't anything else more important in life than to be kind. Because you have a sense of how fragile everything is. It can just finish any moment, you know. And if you didn't say something, if you didn't tell people how much you appreciated or how much you loved them, if you weren't kind to people, you don't know that you'll ever see them again. It's when people come into our lives and we meet them for short amounts of time and we have that opportunity to love them, you see, isn't it? We have that opportunity to just share in a very real way and to love and to be kind to them. And if we don't do that, it's gone. You may never see that person again. It's the same with our relatives. It's the same with people we live with all the time. We forget. But you don't know when they go off to work in the morning that they'll come back at night. You don't know that. Just don't know that. It's like 9/11, isn't it? You go to work in the morning and you don't come back. It happens many times. And the first time I did a Buddhist course, my teacher was teaching the whole course. The good old days. Mama Sopa Rinpoche would teach the whole Kogan course. And there we were, and it was, Kathmandu is 1982. It's like really, really third world. There's no email, there's no telephones, there isn't even any water. You had to walk down to the bottom of the hill for a spring. And we were in this kind of shack kind of place, which was the meditation hall. And I remember, first I remember just the impact of meeting somebody like Rinpoche. That I never knew people like this existed. Never met anybody like this before. If somebody had told me such a person, you just, I wouldn't have believed them. You know, I've been brought up Christian, and you get to a certain point, and you kind of, it doesn't really seem to fit together, how it's presented. Of course, Christianity is extremely profound, and now I've met people who have shown me and who have the presence of God within them. And I see how it fits together. But those days, no, it was more kind of like, you know, you went to Sunday school, and if you ask questions, you'd be told to shut up or get out. And so you'd go to church, and everyone would be really good for an hour, and then they'd go home and do something different. And I remember going through university and like really looking, searching, trying to find something meaningful. I couldn't find anything. And I travelled around Europe and I did this and I did that. And sometimes the professors, they, you know, they walk into the room and they say something really good. And they walk out the room and do the opposite. And you think, oh, it's just words really, isn't it? It isn't really. And suddenly I was confronted with this amazing being who just, even if you didn't know anything about Buddhism, you didn't care, but you could see it was something special. And what did he talk about? He talked about kindness. And then he wasn't just saying something nice. He was. Everything that he was saying, he was. He just had to explain. You know, he'd walk into this kind of little shack, this amazing holy being, just walk into this little shack, and he'd sit up on this throne, and of course everyone would stand up and pay respect. But I remember one day, you know, walking in on these straw mats, and he walks halfway in, and then suddenly he stops, and he bends down, he stoops down, and he's doing something, and he walked out again. I thought, what's he doing? Of course there was an ant on the ground, wasn't there? I couldn't believe somebody would not want to stand on an ant. Can you imagine? It doesn't happen at university that people walk in the door and if there's an ant they turn around and walk out again. Amazing. Anyway, so the point I wanted to make is, Rinpoche spent that whole month, I think, talking about the kindness of the mother. Because in Buddhism, what we try to do is we try to develop our minds to a place where we really feel love for others. We really have a sense of universal responsibility, a sense of caring, like genuine affection and caring for others. And one of the ways to do it is to start by taking an object, someone who's been very, very kind to us. And in Buddhism we use the object of the mother. Mother is somebody who, from the very beginning, had us in the womb for 9 months. And then, of course, gave birth, took all that pain, and then fed us and nurtured us and took care of us. And really never leaves us until they die. They really always, always care. I remember when I was taking care of my mother, I think 2 years I lived with her. And I had to care for her. And, you know, she was dying. She needed a lot of care. There was full-time caring. It was a very demanding job. If I was out of her sight 15 minutes, she'd be calling and crying and upset. You know, where was I? Worrying. I remember one day I used to drive around because she couldn't walk much, so we'd drive around and look at the flowers and look at the sea. And one time I was driving her somewhere and she turned to me in the car and she had tears in her eyes and she looked at me and she said, you know, I just couldn't do anything if you weren't helping me. Couldn't do anything. I would be totally helpless. And I just looked at her and I said, but you took care of me for so many years. What I'm doing is nothing. Now, it's a very interesting phenomenon in the West that many people don't think their mother's being kind. So here's Rinpoche talking about the kindness of the mother over and over again, and you would not believe the reaction on this bunch of travellers. They are either screaming angry, violently sick, or, you know, in tears day and night. And there I was, and all I wanted to do was just run down to Kathmandu and pick up the phone and say, Mom! I love you! We weren't allowed to do that. Thank God. My mother would have had a fit. She would have booked the next flight to Kathmandu and said, what are they doing to you? What are they doing to my child? She's never been like this before. She used to be normal. Spoiled. Ungrateful. Unappreciative. Leave her alone. Yeah, the kindness. And then I remember after Mother died, it's like, you know, there was that caring. It's like there was just a sense that actually everyone is my mother, really. When you saw suffering, you would just feel, well, I should help, you know, I should help. Of course, this feeling is gone now. It was very nice while it was there. And I remember also the grief. And I went to see this one lama, I was in Bodh Gaya. I managed to get to India. I was really stricken with grief, because when you care for somebody like that, it's always a kind of thankless task, because you can't stop anyone from dying. You know, you do everything and they still die. It's great, isn't it? So nobody told me the hardest part of somebody dying is when they've gone. And suddenly you're alone. And there you are, you've been listening to them breathing for weeks and months, checking that they're still alive, and suddenly they're not there anymore. And you really feel like there's no reason to live. You feel like that. And you also remember all the mistakes that you made. It's incredible. Ask anyone who does caring. You don't rejoice in the good things. You just, first of all, you just think of the mistakes. And then, so much grief. I just couldn't put it all together. Couldn't put it all together. I remember going to see this one Nyingma Lama, a very holy being. And I said to him, you know, since my mother died, I just can't make sense of things. I just can't put things together. I feel like there's nothing to hold on to anymore. And he looked at me and he said, make the most of it. It won't last long. Don't you just love Buddhists? I was telling Nitra a story this morning about one of my teachers in, used to be in London, Geshe Wangchen, and one of the students went to see him and they said, oh Geshe, I've met the most amazing woman and we're going to get married. And he looked at him, you know, deeply in the eyes, and he said, I'm really sorry. But the wonderful thing is, you see, after my mother died, all these people came up to me with all these stories and all this nonsense. You know, the worst thing is the grieving, is that the grievers, you know, they come up and they say, oh, don't worry, your mum, you know, she's up in heaven, sipping a cocktail with your dad, da 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 da, you know, you this kind of things. Oh, such a lot of nonsense they came up with. And I just thought to myself, I just love the Buddha, because he tells the truth. It's really hard to die. It's really suffering. And it's not easy. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do. And it's like Buddha tells you straight out, look everybody, you are going to die. Prepare, get ready for it. And take a strong, hard look at this life. They say that until you realize you're going to die, you don't really know what it means to be alive, you see. You don't really see how precious it is. And then things get wasted. And then we end up just doing all these things which don't have any meaning and harming people. You know, we harm ourselves. So why would we care about other people? I mean, we harm ourselves, we harm other people. That's what we do. We don't know any better. But suddenly when there's this understanding that life is so precious, you know, and every single person is going to die. This, really, you know, we share this suffering. We share the situation of being in this human body, which has so many problems, so hard to find satisfaction, so difficult. We share this with everybody else. And we have the potential to use our lives to help others. Oh, we can see that. When we see the suffering, when we see our own suffering, we see our own condition, we can see that of others. And then we can really do something with our lives. So that when we look back, we feel happy, we feel pleased. We think, well, at least I was able to do this. At least I was able to do that. I went to visit one lady in California who was dying. And she had a lot of difficulty breathing that night, but when I got there, she was actually okay. And I handed her a picture of the Dalai Lama. He has his palms together and he's smiling. And she stared at it and she said, oh, that's love. And then she said, you know, I don't have any regret about dying because I have tried to use my life for others. I thought it was great. I really hope, you know, for me, I really hope when it comes time to die that I can say that. It would be really nice. I know my mother used to think like that. I don't know how everybody here feels. But the reason I'm talking about this also is because, you know, Rinpoche, in this whole ultimate healing book, Rinpoche presents different ideas. You know, one is the whole notion of the mind, and another is just breaking our wrong concepts, ignorance, what we don't know. And one of our wrong concepts is that we're not going to die. So until the doctor actually says you're going to die, we just never think about it, we don't do anything about it. You know, when I was in Florida, the director said, when you're young, you just don't think about it. You don't care. I mean, it just never comes in your head. And then it's only when you get older and then you look back and you think all the things. We talked yesterday about older people. My teacher said, the problem in the West, he said, is that you have all these old age homes. He said, the people in them, now of course, this is making generalization, right? But what Rinpoche says, in the East, you see, people really try to live a good life. So when they get older, then they look back and they rejoice. They think about all the things they've been able to do, and they rejoice. And Rinpoche said, you know, in the West, the things they have to rejoice about are all the things that have gone now. That they had kids, but the kids have grown up and gone, you see. That they had this job, and maybe the husband's gone, or the wife is gone. So what do they do, you see? And then now they're going to die, and some people just said they're wishing they'd die quicker. It's true. Believe me. I saw it with my mother. Sometimes she would just pray that she could die quicker so she wouldn't be such a burden. Don't think it's not like that. It can be like that for us. It's like that for others. And if you can hear this from your heart, then you can also hear how, you know, we should love others. We should allow ourselves to feel that suffering and to see that we have a responsibility. I mean, what is there to look forward to? Death. You're just going to get more sick, you know, different parts. There could be pain. It's like, please just let me go quicker. This is the kind of thought they have. They don't want to be a burden. In America, I don't know how it is in New Zealand, in America, oh boy, because you have to pay for everything, right? So if the parents are sick for a long time, the family doesn't inherit anything. Horrible, isn't it? So the family is kind of thinking, well, how long are they going to last? And the parents are kind of thinking, well, I wish I could just go faster. It's like, can you imagine? So why do we think about death? We think about death because it's like, I say like this, it's like when you truly have this understanding that you're going to die, you know, by reflecting on different reasonings and thinkings, when you can truly come to a sense, it's almost like you had just walked out of the doctor's and the doctor had just said to you, I'm really sorry, but you're going to die. And it like hits you so strongly, you know, every single thing is going to go. When you really have this kind of understanding, it's like you get your life back. I put it like this. It's like you have been given back your life. Why do I say that? I say that because you now have the opportunity to do whatever you want with your life, whereas ordinarily it just happens. And it's like you just get under the control of this or that and you just go along, and it's like you're not really. Are you with me? It's like you've been given your life back. It's like, you know, well, I haven't died yet. And look, I mean, today I can do something, tomorrow I can do something. Okay, heck, look, if I live a week, I'll do this and this and this. I mean, go away and make a list. What am I going to do? The very first thing on the list is probably going to be I'll call my mum. Seriously. It's like, I'm going to be more kind. What do I want to do if I think I only have a week left? Well, I might not have that long. okay, if I only have a day left, what will I do? Well, at least today I'm just going to be kind. I mean, if I can't be kind, at least I'm not going to harm anybody. And I'm just like not going to get caught up in my stuff. I'm just not going to do that. I'm just not going to let my mind go to all these places that they go to, which just drags it down and drags everybody else down with me. I'm not going to do that anymore. So Rinpoche says, you know, thinking about the fact that we're going to die, he said, then that brings up within you the possibility to decide to really think, you know, what is the meaning of life? What is the meaning? What is the purpose of my being alive? It's a very good question to ask yourself. It's a very important question. My teacher didn't have any doubt what the answer is. But you see, even if I gave you the answer that he has, it has to be your answer. You know? Even Rinpoche says over and over and over again, from the minute you wake up in the morning, think like this. It has to become one's own answer. And it can only be your own answer by really thinking deeply, reflecting on these things. What do I want to be remembered for? You know, the only thing that's going to remain, all your possessions are going to be given away, your money will be distributed. I mean, have you made a will? It's incredible, be careful. It's like people die, you know, getting anxious because they didn't do this, didn't do that. And then other people fight and there's quarrels. Some people, when they die, it just starts up feuds and quarrels. It's very nice to make a will and to say, okay, if I were to die tonight, then I want this person to have this, and I want this, and I want this, and I want, you know, like give. Just give it all away. Give it all away. Just. And, I can't remember what I was going to say. Anyway, just the idea is here now, we're looking. Now, if I get my life back, what do I want to do with it? If I only have a day left, what am I going to do? If I have a week left, what am I going to do? If I actually have the privilege of living one more year, wow, what an honor, what a privilege, what am I going to do? It doesn't mean you quit your job. It doesn't mean you go up the mountains and leave your family. It might mean that well, I guess ideally it would mean that when you do your job, you just do it differently, you know? And when you're with your family, you're with your family differently. Because there's a new sense of appreciation and love. And also that every single person you meet is going to die. I was up in Vermont last winter time. Rinpoche sent me off to do a retreat, and he told me to meditate on death and impermanence. It was around the time when the war, they were, you know, going on about the war. And I really got to a point where I couldn't stand the thought that every day people were creating so much negative imprints in their minds, you know, wanting to fight, thinking it's good to fight, being angry, being afraid, having hatred. All these people, like millions of people in America, were doing that. And all those people are going to die. And what are they doing with their lives? They're just making their minds black. It's so sad. And I had to feel to myself, look, if I've got to go, you know, I want to stay here to retreat, but I can't do that. I've got to go out and give some talks. I mean, I've got to go and talk about peace. Because if just one person listened, then that's one person, you know, that's maybe, even just for 1 or 2 hours, if they could just change their minds, if they could just bring their minds towards the light, it would be worth it. And you see, I'm nothing special at all. I really feel like this. Sometimes people say, oh, well, you're a nun, and you know, you've got this kind of lifestyle, and blah, blah, and you give talks. And I think, well, that just happens to be like the slot that I'm in. But, you know, Chinrezig, we talk about the Buddha of Compassion. Chinrezig has 1,000 arms. And each of those arms are in the mudra of helping, giving whatever's needed for sentient beings. And each of those arms has an eye and a palm which sees the sufferings of beings and just wants to help. Chimuzi has 1,000 arms, and every one of us is one of those arms, you see. Every one of us has people that we have connection with. Maybe people we're married to, maybe people we gave birth to, maybe people who gave birth to us, maybe people we work with. We all have the privilege and the honour of being with others who are precious, who we can help. And we have that responsibility. I really feel that. I don't think, I mean, sure, we can walk out this door, we can walk away from our merger and say, oh, it was kind of okay weekend, and now I'll just go back and do my own thing. But, I don't know, I just feel like, if we manage to get here, we manage to walk in the door, we manage to come together and share this time together, then it also means that in our hearts we are looking for something, and you can bet that everyone else is also looking for that. And we've touched it, you see, we know. And we can live it. Just like the Dalai Lama lives his truth and affects millions, we start off by living our truth and affecting even just one. My teacher says, even just one. You know, Lama Oso Rinpoche is the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe, who founded this organization with my teacher Kabje Zopa Rinpoche. He was just giving a talk one day about Lama Oso. And, you know, since he was a young toku, he's a Spanish boy, since he was a young toku, he's been trained and he lived in the monasteries, and now he's having a Western education. And Rinpoche said, you know, when we dedicate, let's dedicate for Lama Oso to be able to benefit as much as possible. And then he made a little aside and he said, you know, to benefit as much as possible doesn't have to be many people. It might just mean that he benefits one. In some ways, I almost think that the most courageous bodhisattvas live their whole lives just to benefit one. You know, it's easy when there's a lot of people, isn't it? Easy to think, oh, I'm really doing a good job, or da 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 da. But no, I mean, just one. Just one. The Zen teachings, each sentient being is so precious, the most precious, more precious than the Buddha. Because every single being is cherished by the Buddha, every single being can become Buddha, you see. Where does Buddha come from? Buddha comes from sentient beings. Every single being can be Buddha. And so that's our job. Our job is to nurture, our job is to help others, to develop kindness, to nurture them, to give them the space to work out their stuff, to find out, you know, all the stuff in the mind that needs to be worked out and to work it out and to change and to develop. To do that, we need to do the work ourselves. That's why we do all these things. Because if we don't do it, we can't help others. Every sentient being is precious and kind. Most precious and kind in my life, I'm sure says. Think like that. Every time you see somebody, just think how precious they are. Why? Because they're giving you the opportunity to be kind. They're giving you the opportunity to practice patience. They're giving you the opportunity to love. They're giving you... Everything we have comes from others. Not only all the material things, but also our whole practice. To be able to keep even one vow, not to harm or not to steal, not to kill. We need others. We need others. We can't become enlightened without others. Becoming enlightened happens because you cherish every single living being. And my teacher says, and you can't leave one out. You can't leave one out. You have to cherish Bin Laden. You have to cherish Saddam Hussein. I mean, doesn't your heart go out to Saddam Hussein? Poor guy. There he was, caught in this pit. Poor guy. Look what he goes into death with. Look what he goes into death with. Poor guy. I mean, George Bush, look what he goes into death with. You wouldn't want to be the victor and you wouldn't want to be the defeated, would you? You just wouldn't want to look back over your life and think that you've done those things. So many people have been killed. So many people have suffered. Just like Bin Laden. Imagine going into death with that. That was how you used this precious life. You know, you had influence, you had power, and what did you do? It's very sad. Dharma has influence and power, and he brings people up with him. He brings people with him. They say, take along the path those who help and those who harm. Everyone you make contact with, everyone you meet, bring them along with you. Bring them along with you. Don't get stuck on the personality or the figure that's being presented. Look at the heart. The heart is that there is another being who wants happiness just like myself, doesn't want to suffer just like myself. And my responsibility is to help them. This is the heart of the Buddha's teachings now. This is really it. And my teacher says, you know, if you can love just one other being, you can love all of them. And I used to think about that. I often say this actually. I often give this example. You know, I used to listen to Rinpoche teaching. So I'm a Buddhist nun, right? So, you know, I don't have relationships. I don't have all these. You know, I don't have kids. So I was thinking, what is he saying? I mean, if you can love just one other, you can love all. I mean, what is he talking about? I don't get it. I mean, loving one is easy. I mean, loving all of them? Boy, that's a lot. And then my mother got sick, and I had to go and take care of her. And suddenly I was with this one other being. And could I, like, totally, completely love her? No. Because there was all this stuff inside me. There were still expectations. There was still attachment. There was still wanting or needing, or you know what it's like with a mother and a daughter, don't you? It's fraught. Totally fraught. You know, mother's manipulating daughter, daughter's manipulating mother. It's amazing. And all that stuff was thrown in my face, and then I suddenly realized what Rinpoche was saying. Even though I love her, I adore her to pieces, but I'm not there yet. I still have a lot of work to do. I have a long way to go. And then you really understand what Rinpoche is saying. You know, that one other person can be the one closest to you, and they are the hardest to love. I mean, I don't know, you might say, oh, she's a Buddhist nun talking, but really. And some people think, oh, she'll go off and become a monk, or she'll become a nun, forget it. I mean, just try to stay with those people that you have that intimate connection with and work. It's the hardest. Hardest. You don't need to go off and become a this or become a that. You just need to do the work. Really, seriously. Some of the best practitioners I know are lay people. Really. Of course, there are many great practitioners. And I'm not putting down being a monk or a nun. It's really amazing. It's incredible. It's essential. You know, the survival of the Buddhist doctrine totally depends on having monks and nuns existing. But it's not an excuse if you're not a monk or a nun to do the practice. Just the same way it's not an excuse if you are a monk or not to do the practice. You see what I'm saying? Because the work has to be done. It doesn't matter what you are, who you are. And you can't fall deaf, you see? When death comes, these thoughts are going to come into your head. Believe me, you're going to think about it. You're going to wonder, what did I do? What was it all about? Why did it happen? And then you're going to see that you were given this precious jewel when you met the Buddha's teachings. You were actually given this precious jewel. You know, what did I do? Did I just put it away? Did I lock it up? Or did I take it out and polish and clean it and use it and let it shine? Because that jewel is your heart, you see. It's your infinite capacity for love. We said this yesterday. The mind has no limits. There's no limit to how much you can love. You can love every single being. Don't think I can only love this much or that much. That's like, you know, measuring out your love. Well, I can give this much, but then they have to give that much back. It's not about that, you see. Love is not attachment. In Buddhism, when we talk about love, we're not talking about attachment. Attachment is kind of sticky and clingy and full of expectation and fickle and, you know, I love this one, I won't love that one, and I did love him, but I don't like him anymore, you know, he didn't do what I wanted. And that's not how it is. Love is just this recognition that, you know, everybody else is just the same as me. I'm the same as everybody else. We all want happiness. We don't want suffering. And you're just wishing everyone to have happiness. Then when it becomes great love, it's like you actually kind of take responsibility and sign the contract and say, look, I'm going to do something about it. I'm actually going to take responsibility so that other people find happiness in this life. They're going to find it through me. I mean, that's not an ego thing. It's like, if I can help, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to stand back. You know, it's not I'm going to go run out and help old ladies cross the road. It's just that I am going to love others. That's what I'm going to do. And you know, in some ways, it's almost like that's enough. In some ways, if you can do that, if you can just be love for others, then you will heal them. They will heal. Rinpoche says, compassion, someone with compassion is a healer. Just by existing, they don't need to do anything else. Isn't it true? You know, we run around and we're like kids and we want this, we don't want that, and we have all these delusions in our minds, so we hurt people and we do this and that, and then we meet people with compassion and they just, whatever we do, it's like the mother, you know, whatever the child does, she never stops loving the child. That kind of love, the mother never stops loving the child. It doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter how ungrateful, how unappreciative, how much they keep demanding. They never stop loving the child. They never stop looking at the best in the child, you see. They know this child. They see the faults. They're not blind to the faults. They see the faults, clearly. But they can see beyond the faults. And that's how it is, you see. This kind of mind you try to develop to all beings. Sure, you see the faults, but you see that they don't have to be the faults. They can go beyond the faults. One of my teachers, Amayeshi, he used to say, just because I love all sentient beings doesn't mean I have to like them. I like that very much. You see this in Buddhist philosophy. They say, look, you've got a problem with somebody, do this. Separate, mentally separate the thing you don't like, the faults, you know, like mentally separate the delusions from the person and see that the person is themselves are suffering from the delusion. You don't like the delusion, but the person you can still have an open heart towards. There can still be spaciousness towards that person. You don't throw away the person because of delusion. Why? I mean, we have delusions. Are we going to throw ourselves away? No. We have to mentally separate our delusions from ourselves also and see that we're worthy of being loved. You see, this is one of the problems, is we don't love ourselves. We don't love ourselves, so it's quite hard to love others. We don't see ourselves as worthy of being loved. It's difficult in the West. It really is difficult. We bring along a whole lot of stuff. You look at the Asians, I look at the Tibetans, and from a young age, you know, they're running around, they're being natural, they're... In the West, it's not like that. You run around and mom says, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. You know, it's like you're very controlled and you're reined in. And it's like, in Tibet, it seems just like the kids go wild. But it seems to work. I can't quite find out how it works. In America, they let the kids go wild and it doesn't work. But Tibetans seem to be able to do it. And then when they get to a certain age, they kind of rein them in. And they turn out really great. And I can't quite fear it. But they don't have the sense that they're not worthy to be loved. They don't feel that. It's this famous conference with His Holiness Dalai Lama where they were talking about, one of the Westerners brought out the whole subject of self-hatred. And Thupten Jinpo is a really good translator. He was translating and he said, can you just explain what that means so I can translate it? And they explained what it meant. This is a room full of people with PhDs, you know, top of their field, psychologists, psychotherapists. They explained to Jinpo what it meant. He translated it to His Holiness. His Holiness said, what? And so then Jinpo explained to him what it meant. And he said, oh, do you have that in the West? Self-hatred. And everyone was nodding their head and saying, yeah, there's a big problem. There's a big problem in the West. And then His Holiness said, oh, do any of you experience this? Everyone stuck their hand up. His Holiness said, oh. So it almost feels that we have to begin with ourselves. And one way to do that is just, you see, in Buddhism for us it's quite easy because one of the qualities of Buddha is that Buddha loves every single being. When Buddha sees any single being, what he experiences is just the greatest love and affection. I gave the example yesterday when the Dalai Lama walks on the stage and he's just love. And that love is just returned. It's just this joy. You feel this joy in your heart. You feel like, oh. This is one of the qualities of Buddha, is they just love. You watch with the Lama. And if you have the privilege to see my teacher when he comes, you watch. Everyone who comes in front of him, he's completely there with them, just pouring love into them. But when they're gone, they're gone. It's not sticky. Don't cling on to them and say, stay here, I've got to love you. No, he's on to the next one. Why? Because he loves every single being equally. There's nobody special, nobody's more close. Every single being is special, every single being is close. It's an incredible mind. You know, we're not brought up with this kind of mind, we're not brought up to think about this kind of mind. So we think love has got to, you know, it's like it's got to be weighed out and measured and you can only have so much. And it's not like that, you see. Because you get rid of the attachment, you get rid of the clinging, you get rid of the expectation, you get rid of all the sticky stuff. In the West, when they have all these songs, you know, I love you, and they're all crying, what does it mean? It means, you know, oh, I want to cling on to you and hold you, and you've got to keep making me happy. It's like it's not, it's sticky, it's all got kind of polluted. So when we talk about generating a measurable love, we're talking about generating this kind of mind, where there is just, you know, openness and space and kindness for every being. You don't want anyone to suffer. If that person helps or harms you, you still don't want them to suffer. It's like a doctor, no matter who comes to the doctor to be cured, you know, whether they're nice or not. I mean, if they're suffering, the doctor should cure them, right?